This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, can Israelis and Palestinians make peace? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. November marks the 20th anniversary of the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by a Jewish extremist. For many, the murder of Rabin, the man who championed the Oslo Peace Accords, foreshadowed the death of the peace process. A new book by journalist Dan Efron chronicles what he sees are the mistakes that followed Yitzhak Rabin's 1995 assassination. While incremental progress has been made since 1995, many attempts to reach a conflict-ending agreement have failed, from U.S. President Bill Clinton's Camp David summit in 2000 to the 2008 offer by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to the recently aborted efforts at jump-starting talks by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. In fact, in his address to the U.N. General Assembly in late September, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced that Palestine was no longer bound to previous agreements, including the Oslo Peace Accords. Moreover, the Palestinians are divided between the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip and Palestinian Authority-controlled West Bank, and we are witnessing a fresh wave of violence between Palestinians and Israelis, particularly in Jerusalem, sparked by allegations that Israel is threatening to take over the control of the East Jerusalem holy site, known to Muslims as the Al-Aqsa Mosque and to Jews as the Temple Mount. A spate of stabbings of Israelis by Palestinians and the retaliatory actions against Palestinians by the Israeli security forces have resulted in more than 90 deaths in the month of October and left people on edge. The violence prompted UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to urge both sides to take steps to de-escalate the situation. Recently, Secretary of State John Kerry helped broker an agreement between Israel and Jordan that entails installing video surveillance at the Al-Aqsa compound, Temple Mount, to refute claims that Israel wants to change the rules that allow Muslims to pray there, but not Jews, and also to show where the provocations are really coming from. The rising tide of violence has sparked talks about the possibility of a third intifada and makes the prospects of reaching a two-state solution anytime soon look dismal at best. Well, with us to discuss the escalating tensions and violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and if there is any silver lining in the current turmoil, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Natan Sachs is a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a think tank based in Washington. And Greith Al-Omari is senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was formerly executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine. Natan Sachs joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Greith Al-Omari, welcome to the program here in the studio.
Thanks.
Well, let me begin with you, Greith. And before I ask you both questions, Greith, of course, is a Palestinian by birth and Natan is Israeli by birth. But either one are not speaking on behalf of either side, but rather bringing to bear their keen insights of both populations. So first to you, Greith Al-Omari, what is your reaction to the current spate of violence in Jerusalem? And to what extent do you think efforts to diffuse these tensions will take effect?
To look at the effectiveness of efforts to diffuse, you have to understand what caused this. And you actually captured it in your introduction. On the one hand, we had the trigger, what's happening on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, the fears that this engendered in everyone. But this came on top of an already tense situation. A tense situation whereby, let's put it this way, my generation, people who were born in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we remember Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat's handshake in the White House. We remember hope. The generation that was born in the 90s only remembers failure, all of these failed attempts that you mentioned in the introduction. And therefore, this comes after years of occupation and a Palestinian public that feels no particular hope of things moving forward. And complicating this is the failure of the Palestinian leadership to provide a model. The Palestinian Authority has been suffering from corruption and mismanagement and really has no program to its public. So this is the complex reality. In the short term, what we saw recently with the attempts to diffuse in the Temple Mount will certainly help bring the temperature down. But unless we deal with the root causes, we are bound to face these kinds of incidents over and over and over again.
Turning to you, Natan Sachs, for your take on the current spate of violence, the root causes as well as the more proximate ones.
As I had said, I think it's a combination of both. We have, on the one hand, proximate causes, tension over Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif in Arabic is wider than just the mosque itself. It includes also the Dome of the Rock, where two Jewish temples stood thousands of years ago, and in a sense encapsulates the conflict more than anywhere else. It's the holiest site for Jews, but barred for entry for most Orthodox Jews. But it's also one of the most holiest sites for Muslims. And as a result, it's been the focal point of clashes many times in the past. In particular, the Second Intifada was sparked by a visit by then-opposition leader Ariel Sharon, Israeli opposition leader, to the Temple Mount. And time and time again, in fact, if we go back to the 20s, the 1920s, then to the first spates of violence, long before there was an Israel, had to do with what was then called as well the status quo around the Temple Mount and the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, just to the west of the Temple Mount. And so this is the proximate cause, and it's been a powder keg for a long time, the holiest site in the region, and one that brings this conflict from a national place to a religious place, a very dangerous one to my mind. But there's a wider context, of course, and the wider context is the stalemate, the very deep sense of impasse on the diplomatic side. It's not just that the two sides failed to reach peace, it's that more and more people on both sides, especially the Palestinian, but the Israeli as well, are now feeling that there really isn't much hope of a two-state solution in this near future or perhaps ever. And therefore, there's kind of a sense of puzzlement of what might come in its place. The general sense and the general fear is that more of the same is what's coming now. And this leads to despair, what Raith also described on the Palestinian side. For Israelis, too, a sense that this isn't going anywhere much and that there's not much point to diplomatic efforts. It boils down, in a sense, to what we're seeing now, a very troubling situation, one especially focused on Jerusalem, which is a unique situation. Unlike the West Bank, which is divided between Israeli rule and Palestinian rule, but most Palestinian people are ruled by the Palestinian Authority, in East Jerusalem, Israel has full control, but it's not fully incorporated into Israel. And as a result, we have a bit of a no man's land, and that's where we're seeing the violence right now.
Back to you, Raith Al-Omari, before we get into the underlying causes, back to this Al-Aqsa Mosque, Temple Mount dispute. Of course, we hear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu say that the status quo has not changed and will not change. But oftentimes these words aren't met by actions on the ground. You see perhaps groups over which he doesn't have much control, some very Orthodox Jews or extremist groups who do challenge, as Natan Sachs said. They go to the Temple Mount, they provoke. What do you think can be done besides the cameras? And how about this discrepancy between words and deeds?
There are two categories of deeds that we see which are counterproductive, from the Israeli side at least. The first one, I would say, are, as you mentioned, the extremist groups that are beyond anyone's control. You can try to tamp them down and whatnot, but there's not much you can do about them, except in certain cases when they cross a certain line, they can and should be banned. But the more problematic one is when you start seeing provocative action coming from Israeli officials. The current round started by a visit by actually an Israeli cabinet minister to the site. A day after the Jordan, the U.S. and Israel reached the agreement on the holy site and the cameras, the Israeli deputy foreign minister made a very provocative statement. And this requires decisive action by the prime minister. This is what needs to be done on the one hand. But on the other hand, and this is a deeper problem, one of the reasons that people do not believe the statements of the prime minister is that we have a very deep crisis of trust between the two sides. And this is not one that you can overcome by simple statements. You need deeds, not only deeds on the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, but also deeds by the Israeli government in the wider West Bank and in the Gaza Strip to show that there is an Israeli government that might not be willing to do peace today, but is committed to the idea of a two-state solution. Of course, there is a set of reciprocal action that we need from the Palestinian side. But unless we look at the wider context and deal with the trust deficit through constructive action, I fear that neither side will be convinced by the other side's statements and policies.
Natan Sachs, well, speaking of the prime minister, he also had quite an outrageous statement recently, Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting that the World War II era Mufti was responsible for inspiring Adolf Hitler to exterminate European Jewry. I mean, these kinds of statements certainly don't help, do they?
No, they absolutely do not. First, it's in this case very important to state the simple facts. It is factually false. It is not true. About 80% of Lithuania's Jews, I'm actually myself three-quarters Lithuanian, were exterminated before the Mufti ever met Hitler. Hitler was the man behind the extermination of Jews. The Mufti was a rabid anti-Semite and was a cheerleader for the Holocaust, but to claim that he was behind it is factually false and preposterous. And most people in Israel, it should be made very clear, responded with amazement at the prime minister's assertion, which I think was done offhand. But this is part of the general sense of very deep mistrust. On Temple Mount, for example, there have been some very troubling acts by Israeli politicians on the far right, including visits to Temple Mount. But we should put it in context. That is often taken as an attempt by Israel to destroy the mosque or to radically change the ability of Muslims to pray there. And these things are not true. The status quo as we have since 67 has been that the Israeli authorities themselves have decided to limit the ability of Jews to pray on Temple Mount. So Jews are barred from praying on Temple Mount. In part, this coincides with a prohibition for many Orthodox. In fact, the most Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews, do not believe that Jews are allowed to enter the Temple Mount because they fear that they would accidentally enter what was the Holy of Holies of the Temple, something that only the high priest could do once a year on Yom Kippur. And as a result, the most Orthodox do not even go up. But some of the national Orthodox, the national religious, tend to be the most nationalist among Israelis, although not only. Some of them do believe that some of the Temple Mount can be entered and is the holiest site, of course, for Jews, and would like to pray there. So many of them are framing this as a religious freedom issue, as one where they should be allowed to pray there as just anyone else would be. And this is very difficult for Israelis to counter. Of course, the counter is that despite the fact that it does limit their religious freedom, it is very dangerous for peace. And so the result is that then when you get people like the deputy foreign minister and others who go up there and sometimes pray quietly before the police ask them to leave, you get people among Palestinians and others who claim that Israel is about to destroy the foundations of the mosque, to bring it down, all these things which just are wild claims that are unrelated to reality. As you pointed out, though, when you get rhetoric that goes back to the Holocaust and things like this, when it becomes so heated and so divorced from reality, it feeds on itself, I'm afraid.
Back to you, Reith Al-Omari. So we have incitement on the Israeli side, outrageous statements, visits to Haram al-Sharif, which are provocative. But there's certainly a lot of incitement in the Palestinian media and social media. What role do they play, in your view, in helping to incite violence, these horrible stabbings?
You have two sources of incitement. One is predictable and understandable, is the one that comes from those who intentionally want to inflame, like Hamas, like some of these extremist terrorist organizations. You could expect them to do that. What is more troubling to me and what's more surprising and which should be countered effectively is when it comes from Palestinian leaders who are professing commitment to peace, people like President Abbas, who perpetuates these kinds of myths that Natan mentioned, knowing that this is not the truth. Now, why does he do that? He does that because he's a president who feels that his legitimacy is lacking and therefore he wants to take a hardline position to, if you wish, pander to his public. The problem with this, of course, it feeds the worst instincts and the worst tendencies among Palestinians and does translate into this unrest. So this incitement coming from Hamas and the like, not much we can do about it, but to counter it with facts. The incitement that comes from Palestinian officials who believe in a two-state solution, they should be called on it. And this is, I think, one of the things where the U.S. and some of our Arab allies should play a role in telling the Palestinian leaders, yes, we understand your political impulse, but this is unacceptable in principle, and it's counterproductive because it produces the kind of violence that undermines the very goal you're intending to achieve.
Well, back to you, Natan, before we go to a break. What do you have to add or subtract to the amount of incitement that we're seeing in the Palestinian media, social media, and even coming from some of the leaders like Mahmoud Abbas?
This is, of course, a byproduct of just the deep lack of trust, the sense of impasse and stalemate that Reith and I referred to earlier. It's a very sad state of affairs. When you think 20 years ago this week, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, those days were a special time sort of in world affairs. There was this moment, unipolar moment, in a sense that things were being solved. Eastern Europe was going through a beautiful revolution or succession of revolutions. And it seemed like maybe in the Middle East, too, things would be solved. That's not quite the mood in the world today. It's definitely not the mood in the Middle East. Among Israelis and Palestinians, we've really seen all that hope disappear and instead a very deep sense of cynicism. And in this atmosphere of cynicism, wild claims such as the ones we just mentioned can be believed. They don't meet each other much anymore as they used to. They mostly see each other in the context of the conflict. And this feeds on this very insightful but also very damaging atmosphere of both populations to one another, and I should add, by many people outside looking inside at Palestinians and Israelis and willing to believe almost anything.
We'll be back in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Nathan Sachs, from whom you just heard. He's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Reith Al-Omari, he's senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're talking about the upsurge in deadly violence between Israelis and Palestinians, especially in Jerusalem, and what can be done to ease tensions. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Reith Al-Omari, to now look at the underlying causes, the wider context for the violence. We've seen succession of potential peace deals dissipate, the latest attempts by Secretary of State John Kerry. And I was recently talking with the UN Special Envoy for Middle East Peace Process at the United Nations, Mladenov, and he's saying both sides have major obstacles. On the Israeli side, they have to look at withdrawing from the occupied territories. The Palestinians have to come close together. You can't have Hamas ruling the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank. There has to be unity. I mean, it's a dismal situation right now, but are any steps being taken on the Palestinian side to try to unify?
No. The short answer is no. The long answer is both Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank pretend that they want to unify. In reality, they have no interest. I would even add that I see unity right now between the two movements as impossible and even as undesirable, because you have two movements that have opposed objectives. The Palestinian Authority wants a two-state solution, the Palestinian state living side by side with Israel, achieved via diplomacy and peaceful means. Hamas wants the destruction of Israel using violence. So you cannot really have unity on these terms. But what you can do in the meantime is to make sure that one of the two narratives wins, the narrative of peace or the narrative of violence. If we allow right now diplomacy and peaceful means to pay dividend, then those in the West Bank, in the Palestinian Authority who want a two-state solution, can have a degree of legitimacy. Now, how do you give them dividends? Right now, clearly, a peace deal is not possible for political reasons in Israel and Palestine, but things can be done on the ground. Life for the Palestinians in the West Bank is not pleasant, to put it diplomatically. Things can be done to lighten the footprint of the occupation, allow economic development, allow freedom of movement. These kind of things, yes, they will not bring us a two-state solution, but will convince Palestinians that Israelis are serious in taking steps towards a two-state solution. The second thing that needs to be done is to look at the Palestinian Authority itself. Yes, they are committed to a two-state solution, yet their record of governance has been dismal. Corruption, bad governance, closing the political space, all of these things. For the Palestinian Authority to rehabilitate itself, it has to start looking at reform, at democratization, because if you rehabilitate the messenger, in this case the Palestinian Authority, you also rehabilitate the message, and in this case it is the two-state solution. So a combination of Palestinian internal steps and steps by Israel at the moment to show that Israel is still committed to peace through action on the ground could take us a long way.
Quickly, before I turn to Nathan, I wanted to ask you, because this comes up among Israelis and even Jews around the world, do you think fundamentally the Palestinians are resigned to accepting a Jewish state, that is the state of Israel, within territory after, you know, swaps are made? Because there's still now a revival of the sense that the Arab world, the Palestinians in particular, really just will not accept anything but entire territory of Palestine.
It really depends on what you mean by that question. If you mean that the Palestinians, after a peace deal, will become Zionists and will love Israel and will sing the Israeli national anthem, of course not. But to me, that is not important. The question is, can you have a peace deal that will be stable, that will give the Palestinians and Israelis enough, imperfect, but will give them enough to be satisfied with? My answer is yes. I look at the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. I will challenge you to find more than a handful of Egyptians who actually like Israel. Yet the peace treaty has survived since the late 1979 until now, during very, very tough times, including a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. Why? Not because Egyptians like Israel or think that Israel, you know, is a fantastic thing, but because they feel that this peace treaty is in the interest of their nation. And if we can create such a dynamic between Palestinians and Israelis, to me that is sufficient.
Turning to you, Nathan Sachs, now it's your turn to talk about steps that need to be taken and particularly on the Israeli side, do you see any appetite for confidence-building steps that could help reduce the violence on the Palestinian side, reduce the occupation in the West Bank in particular?
The short answer, I am afraid, is also no. The slightly longer answer is it's a bit more complicated. You don't have a sense of appetite now among Israelis to make any gesture of goodwill towards the Palestinians. There's a very strong sense of fear. Everyone I speak to on the ground is very much afraid. If you think of the word terrorism, that's kind of the point, to create fear. And this wave of violence, a very low-tech wave of violence, sort of lone attackers with knives mostly, has actually succeeded very remarkably in this, I'm sorry to say. And so, and in that environment, if you think of fear on the streets, fear of running your own daily life, that's not an environment conducive to making political gestures or making any kind of experiment whatsoever, and certainly not feeling goodwill towards Palestinians and others. On the other hand, the Israeli public can be surprisingly pragmatic with the right leadership and the right moment. So despite what I just said, if there were leadership on both sides that was able to make some kind of concrete move towards reducing the tension, towards reducing the Israeli presence in the West Bank, I have very little doubt that the Israeli public could be swayed to support this. But it needs leadership that believes in this kind of thing. I think on both sides it's very lacking. And so we're really thinking about the next leadership, and I don't know what it would be like. On the Israeli side, we have a leadership that is very, very cautious, is one that does not believe that this conflict can be solved fundamentally, and to my mind has an all-or-nothing approach, a bit like what Reith described earlier, a belief that if Palestinians cannot be swayed to believe in the Zionist cause, to believe that Jews have a right to a state in the Holy Land, etc., then peace isn't worth it at all. And to my mind, peace is a much smaller word than that. It is not reconciliation and deep belief in each other's narratives. It is an agreement to disagree, but not to kill each other while doing it. In other words, we cannot have everything we hoped for. We cannot have beautiful reconciliation, but rather we can have practical steps and perhaps even a peace deal that sees peace in a much more modest way. Steps to start with would include, of course, a limitation on Israeli construction, something that actually quietly Netanyahu has already began to do. And secondly, an attempt to enlarge dramatically the contiguity of Palestinian-controlled territory, their possibility to run their own lives, to allow daily life on the small, mundane, bureaucratic things, things that don't make headlines, that would not satisfy any demonstrators anywhere, but would actually allow Palestinians to have a much better life.
Well, as we close, back to you, Reith Al-Omari. Both of you have echoed that we need new leadership, but short of leadership, that leads us to ask about the role of outsiders. What about the so-called Arab Peace Initiative that people are now resuscitating, saying that, you know, if 22 Arab states can help bring about peace between Israelis and Palestinians, this would help enormously for the region. Many say there are many points of convergence now between many of the Sunni Arab states and Israel. When you look at the context in the region, the rise of Iran and the situation in Syria, do you think it can be a catalyst?
There is definitely convergence of interest between the Sunni Arab states and Israel, and we have seen below the radar screen, in closed rooms, very intensive security and intelligence cooperation and military cooperation even. Yet to think that this will transform into open cooperation between Israel and the Arab world, we're not quite there yet. Where the Arabs will deliver and can deliver, and I think have an interest in delivering, is in pushing the Palestinians to take more responsible rhetoric. And we've actually seen the Jordanians play a very important role in this recently. And in pushing the Palestinians and giving them cover to do more difficult steps, as it were.
The last word to you, Natan Sachs, about this regional approach, and how key, in your view, is it?
I think it's true that a regional strategy is crucial. And I think certainly the Arab Peace Initiative can be a good component, a good platform on which to have this discussion. But it doesn't solve the problems themselves. It's all conditioned on the idea that the Palestinians and the Israelis reach a deal. Same is true now with this convergence of interests. Israelis and the Sunni Arabs certainly have an interest, in part because they see a common enemy in Iran. But that does not mean that they have any new solutions to Jerusalem, any new solutions to refugees, any new solutions to all the other issues of final status. So I certainly think it's an important component, but let's not put our hopes too high on the Arab states being more Palestinian than Palestinian, or being able to convince the Palestinians or the Israelis to change their fundamental views on what they see as their fundamental interests.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Natan Sachs. He's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Reith Al-Omari. He's senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Dave Magnus, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.